Inspired by ESPN's anniversary, ESPN Films 30 for 30 is an unprecedented documentary series featuring 30 films from some of today's finest storytellers. Each filmmaker will bring their passion and personal point of view to their film, detailing the issues, trends, athletes, teams, rivalries, games, and events that transform the sports landscape from 1979 to 2009. For more on 30 for 30, here's your host, Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the 30 for 30 series, The U, premiering on ESPN on the Saturday night after the Heisman special. We find out who wins the Heisman. Boy, I'm on pins and needles. What an exciting Heisman year. But afterwards, 2 hours about one of the most fascinating college programs, I think, ever. And somebody who was living in Miami at the time watched the whole thing unfold. You see him on PTI. You hear him in Miami on the Levitard Show. You read him on Miami, what is it, Miami Online? What's that online site called?
MiamiHerald.com.
MiamiHerald.com.
Come on now, you used to love and respect newspapers. You don't do what you just did there. MiamiHerald.com. You know the name of the paper in Miami.
That was petty. I'm sorry. And also, you love the fact that, he now has a very cool Fu Manchu that makes you look like a drug dealer out of like season 3 of Miami Vice. I'm not even going to say season 1. I'm going to say season 3. When it got a little more hip.
I'm going for the Lou Brown look, manager in Major League. It's what I'm trying to aspire to. Although somebody saw me on outside the lines, and apparently because I've got such a fat face, and they saw me on outside the lines, and they said that I was trying to channel Kenny Powers. So that's what I'm going for.
Oh, I don't know if you want to go for that.
It's a lost cause.
Let's talk about the U. You saw it, correct?
I did. I saw it last night.
And you're in it.
Yes, I am. I am in it. Yes. Yeah. It's my first role in a movie, I think.
I mean, it's basically a movie. What, in your opinion, the biggest misconception about that era for the Hurricanes, which I guess will go from what, 1983 to 1995?
I think it goes to the end of the Dennis Erickson era in the film. I would say the biggest misconception is that we just weren't used to that back then. So what they were doing wasn't that bad. It was just that they were doing it before all these other schools started doing it. And so what was fascinating about it, and I imagine you've had a lot of this watching the 30 for 30 series, viewing it now through an adult's eyes.
Yep.
What I found fascinating is like, I felt like I was watching the formative years of Chad Johnson. I felt like I was talking to his parents and grandparents and saying, oh, this is how it happened. This is how these guys became, you know, Ron Artest and all of this fun, loopy, harmless, or maybe not always harmless, but pretty benign stuff. It started with those teams.
It's almost, I would compare it to Elgin Baylor. And when you say, Elgin, the first guy who played above the rim, and then you see the highlights, and you're like, oh, well. I mean, he wasn't really above the rim. He was in the air. I mean, compared to everybody else, he was definitely jumping higher. But, yeah. But, yeah, I agree with you. I was shocked by how, as you said, benign the stuff seemed. I mean, there was that – what was that one bowl game where they really roughed it up in Texas? I forget who they were playing.
Well, that's the one.
That was a bad one.
That was the one that got a little bit scary because it stopped being sort of fun from the streets and sort of became violence from the streets. I mean, when you think about that particular game, Bill, they gave up 2 football fields worth of penalty yardage.
A bowl record,
and they won, for whatever it was, 44-3. They didn't allow a touchdown while giving up 2 football fields worth of penalty yardage. So rather literally, the rules didn't apply to them.
And also, wouldn't you say white people were reacting a little differently to outspoken black athletes at the time?
Oh, my God.
Let's be honest.
That's the one thing, Bill, that I wish the film had addressed a little bit more. Because I think absolutely that gets received differently if it had been an all-white team behaving that way. That's absolutely a component here that I found hypnotizing. That part of the reaction to that team was absolutely a horrified, scared white America viewing a reckless, reckless black team.
And, you know, you wrote about it on Sunday in the Herald, and you made the very good point, I thought, about how back in the day, Luther Campbell being on the sidelines was like a big deal. It was like, oh, what are they doing? They're letting a rapper on the sidelines. This is horrible. And now it's like Snoop Dogg shows up on somebody's sidelines. Like, hey, cool, it's Snoop Dogg. And it really is. Like, it's so different in the last 20 years how that's evolved.
I think we can find a lot of examples in music and in pop culture where something that's different or pioneering is always met with a great deal of resistance at first. I mean, you know, going back to Elvis and probably before that, that, you know, that it seems apocalyptic at the time, and then you look back at it. I mean, the film was funny, Bill. Is it the first 30 for 30 film that was funny?
Yeah, I mean, the USFL had some funny moments. I think this one had the guys being interviewed. Some of the stuff, you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe you said that. It had a couple of those moments that I don't know if we've really had yet.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. The only thing that I would have liked to have seen tackled just a little bit more, and it's a hard one to tackle, and there's a lot of rich stuff in the film for 2 hours, is that black-white component. Because I would have liked to have heard Jimmy Johnson answer the question, hey, how do you think your team would have been received if it had been exactly the same in all of its behaviors, but had been an all-white football team?
Yeah, it would have been like, oh, look at these tough, wrangled Texans, or tough kids from the South, or, yeah. You know, I think you could also tie in Iverson to that, because to me, he is the most, and continues to be the most compelling case of somebody who as his career unfolded, I think he was treated unfairly. I think his legacy is being treated unfairly, and it's all because people just weren't ready for him when he hit the NBA, and the cornrows and the tattoos and the way he carried himself. They just didn't like it. And that was the bottom line. They just weren't ready for it. And now you look at the way, the highlights of him in 96, 97 and the interviews he gave, and it's benign compared to the stuff we see now. But, you know, whatever.
Well, how do you think it would have been received? How do you think it would have been received if the brawl in the palace, instead of braided guys with cornrows and tattoos, if it had been Troy Murphy and Michael Doliak? Well, that's, yeah, there you go. That's what, like, there you go. Like, that's the thing. I mean, if white fans had been being punched by, those guys, I think the reaction would have been, maybe not laughter, certainly, but I think you and I would be sitting there sort of laughing. But, you know, when it goes into the video viral age that you know, giant black guys with cornrows and tattoos punching white people, that plays to some primal fears.
The thing I noticed, like, when I was watching the beginning of the documentary, you know, I always had in my head, it's not something I thought a ton about, I guess. It was one of those things I'd never really flipped around in my head and really fought through and had some sort of opinion on. But I forgot that University of Miami is actually a nice place to go to school. Like, it's somehow the football program in my head, not having really thought about it, had dwarfed all the other things about, you know, what would it actually be like to, hey, it would be fun to go to school in Miami. You just forget. You just think like, oh, yeah, it's the school with the football.
Well, tell me this, because you were viewing it through, like we talked about, like through less evolved eyes. I found myself making a dirty admission about myself when Kevin Garnett was celebrating on the floor with the Boston Celtics, just unhinged, crazy, happy. I like Kevin Garnett. I liked everybody on that team, loved Doc Rivers, and loved that Celtics team for everything they did, and found myself instinctively, and, you know, Gladwell writes about some of this stuff in Blink, I found myself instinctively recoiling at how, reckless his joy was. I didn't like what it said about me. So I'm wondering if you, growing up in Boston, viewing specifically those Miami teams that were so foreign in the way that they were behaving, flamboyant, reckless, I wonder if it played into any of that stuff, the way that you viewed those teams, and by extension the city and Miami Vice, and that you forget, yeah, it's on a manicured Coral Gables campus run by a president named Tad.
Well, you're asking the wrong person, because I'm the same guy who gave himself a Muslim name at age 6. So I actually was always enjoyed the Miami team. And I watched the entire BC Miami game which, in my opinion, was the game that kind of put Miami on the map, as weird as it sounds. I mean, I thought, I can't remember what happened the year before. Was the Rozier game? When was that?
They had that. That was the 83 championship year. And then
see, my mask moved up. For me, it's like, that was the game that Miami really felt like, all right, these guys are actually here to stay, and beating them is a big deal. You know what I mean? Whereas the year before, I know they had had the whole thing where they come out of nowhere. Oh, look at this program. But beating
Miami.
Memory
is a loss? Your memory is a loss? I mean, they lost five games that year. Jimmy Johnson only lost nine games his entire time here. And he lost five games that year. And the thing that you think put them on the map was a loss, huh?
No, put them on the map for me. Because it was a big deal to me, and I was still a BC fan at the time, that they beat Miami. It was like, wow, we beat Miami. So when you think like 2 years before, the program was nothing. That's pretty substantial that they had reached that point so quickly. And I still remember watching the Rozier game. But I think, you know what, one of the things that fascinated me was the types of personalities they had. You know, I remember reading that book about the Philadelphia Eagles that was written by
Mark Bowden.
Which was an awesome book. What was that
book
called?
Great book. Heat, something with heat in the title.
Bringing the Heat. That's what it's called. And Jerome Brown was such a huge character in that book. And he's this larger-than-life, amazing guy. And you read that book, and you're like, wow, I feel like I missed the boat on Jerome Brown.
He, to me, represents Miami more than any player ever, more than Michael Irvin. Jerome Brown represents Miami more than any player ever in almost every way, cartoonish, caricature, scary, funny, dying young, like his life and death, all of it couldn't have been more symbolic of that program.
But he wasn't in the documentary enough, in my opinion.
Couldn't have been in it enough, although really, what more do you need than him at... what more do you need than him at midfield with the story that they tell in the documentary that the microphones were removed from midfield captaining because of the things that Jerome Brown would say? And here's this man who is just jiggling menace. I mean, Michael Irvin tells this great story of playing in the pros with Kevin Gogan, tells this great story. And Kevin Gogan is his teammate, and Kevin Gogan leaves the field. And Michael's like, get out there. Why aren't you playing? We need you out there. Now, Kevin Gogan viewed as one of the dirtiest, toughest players in the league. And Michael's like, what hurts? And Kevin Gogan just starts circling every area from his chest to his groin, just starts circling it. And Michael Irvin goes, man, that doesn't hurt. You just don't want to play against Jerome Brown.
Why would he? The other thing is, how many larger-than-life guys did that university have? I mean, they probably had 60% of all the larger-than-life college football players the last 20 years, you know, from a personality standpoint.
Well, there are crazy stats about the talent that South Florida produces where I think Miami's got 35. The city of Miami's got 34 or 35 guys in the pros. And then Fort Lauderdale, which is adjacent to Miami, is fifth or sixth in the country in number of pros from an area. They've got 12. They've got more than Los Angeles, Bill. Fort Lauderdale, which is just poor man's Miami, has more guys in the pros than Los Angeles does.
All right, so you're growing up there, and the football team stinks, but yet you have all of these high school All-Americans and this huge talent base, and they're just going to other schools. What took them so long to get their act together?
That's funny because I thought Melvin Bratton said one of the things in the film that one of the phrases in the film that stayed with me, called Miami a microwave dynasty. They just sort of figured out, hey, we can go to the toughest streets in the world and go get in America, go get players from there and bring them on campus, bring them close to the library, close to higher education. There was less of a separation between, you know, the mean streets and academia, and Howard Schnellenberger bridged it. I mean, you heard in the film some of the players talking about when Howard Schnellenberger came into our neighborhood, there would be whispers all over the place. Hey, who's this white person? Why is there a white person in our neighborhood? And you know, it just took a while for, it's still an uneasy tension. But like you notice, this is something that gets me in trouble every time I say it, but you've noticed that Nebraska doesn't get good, champion good, until Lawrence Phillips is in their huddle. That Ohio State doesn't get champion good, doesn't make the bridge, the jump from good to great, until Maurice Claret is in their huddle. That Florida now has had 27 players arrested under Urban Meyer. That, you know, Colorado, the one year that they played for the championship, they had a third of their team had been arrested. A third of it had an arrest record. Like,
you sound like a Notre Dame grad right now. Explaining why you stink.
That is right. Like that's absolutely part of it. You need a little bit. You need a little bit of. Nobody likes to hear it, but you need a little bit of that in your huddle in a violent game.
Well, I saw the rough cut, which the final version has to take out some of the Schnellenberger stuff just for Schellenberger. Wait, Schnellenberger. Schnellenberger. There's an N in there, right? In the beginning.
Schnellenberger. Yes, yeah. There's an N in there.
You know, I have like pronunciation dyslexia, but in the rough cut it went into a little bit more just how bummed out he was that he left to take this USFL job that ended up not materializing. It was one of the worst careers. It was Caruso-esque how bad that career move was.
Tommy Tuberville tells a great story as the graduate assistant at Miami before he went on to Auburn and all that stuff, in which he was driving Jimmy Johnson to the airport to go to Dallas, to go to coach the Cowboys for ego and glory and money. And Jimmy Johnson always advises his assistants, don't leave college. The pros are gross. Don't leave college. Stay in college. And none of them listen to him. But Tommy Tuberville, like as he's driving to the airport, is driving Jimmy Johnson over a bridge and over water, and he adjusts his rearview mirror, and he sees that Jimmy Johnson is in the back seat sobbing because he knows he's leaving Miami. Like, I think these guys realize, because Jimmy Johnson's the only one who's had any kind of success, real success, post-Miami, like the success that he had at Miami, I think they all realize, too late in many cases, that the school makes the coach at Miami. The coach does not make the school.
And as you said, that the talent advantage you get from being able to dip into the inner city in Miami.
Of course, it'll make anyone a genius.
Yeah. The Latino community, did they embrace this team?
Everybody in Miami did. I mean, I'm sure America hated this team, right? I mean, this was the team of, gangs, I guess, like them. I guess young people probably like the anarchy in them, but America hated those teams. But you know how that goes. Hey, they may be thugs, but they're our thugs, you know?
Like, well, the Luther Campbell part pushed it over the top, you know, because that happened right at a point where people were, you know, parents and stuff were saying, all right, what's going on with this rap? We got to get a hold of this. Right. This has got to control. My kids are listening to this.
Right.
And, you know, you hear some of the Luther Campbell stuff now, and it's just does not hold up. But, you know, at the time, it was like a little bit revolutionary. Like, he's using language, he's talking about all this stuff, and it's like, whoa.
Luther. Well, how great is it? How scandalous is it looking back? Like, we can laugh at it now. And people in that theater at the screening last night in a really tough section of Miami, it was nice to see them do it in Overtown, a place that not a lot of people go, a lot of white people go, not a lot of lights go and films and cameras, you know, a place of riots. Like, it was cool that they did it there. But they were laughing in the theater, and this was not met with laughter at all as it was happening. But looking back on it now, the idea, Bill, that a rap star, okay, the rap star was paying these players with big hit money and putting bounties on Notre Dame with, no, wait a minute, it gets better, this wasn't even in the film, but it gets better, that a rap star was doing this with these players, with, you know, the help of NFL players who were making a lot of money and sending money down as well, and that the money was being distributed by the current coach, Randy Shannon. The current coach was the one who was distributing this money for big hits and for bounties, and that the money was being held. I'm not making this up, Bill. He didn't know he was holding it, but the money was being held by the team priest.
Oh, no.
What do you mean, oh no? Oh, yes.
Well, it sounds like this should, you know, this documentary made me realize somebody really should do the 600-page oral history of this whole era, because they, you know, in 2 hours with commercials, it's really only about an hour, 35 of content. I personally saw from the rough cut that they had to leave stuff out, and it's just, there's so much stuff. It's so rich, and there's, it goes in so many different directions, and so many compelling characters. And then that's, we haven't even mentioned Michael Irvin yet, or Ray Lewis,
or Warren Sapp,
or Warren Sapp. I mean, it's unbelievable.
The stories that didn't get told, you know, Cortez Kennedy having to be restrained because he wanted to fight. He thought it'd be funny to punch the Seminole horse before a game. You know, Charles Farms, the safety who showed up for games dressed in black because he was the Grim Reaper in mourning for the other team, and the shirt would read "Shut up," and he'd you know, before an LSU game. This is the only time I've ever seen this happen, where a defensive tackle from Miami against LSU chased down a wide receiver from LSU, chased him down 60 yards downfield without an angle. Before that game, LSU had placed a cage tiger outside of the UM locker room to intimidate them at 8 o'clock in Cajun country, drunken Cajun country. And the Hurricanes kept sticking their arms and hands in the cage as they came out of the locker room and saying, "Here, kitty, 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 coochie-coo, coochie-coo," like, and then they go out and they win by 6 or 7 touchdowns. there are a million stories like that. It's not, that's one or two, but there are a million stories like that about that era.
Who got the biggest laugh in the theater last night?
Randall Hill got a lot of laughs for some of the stuff that he was saying, because he was saying, and if this doesn't articulate the Miami attitude of the time, I mean, a lot of people remember. I don't know, what would you say is the signature, outside of the Flutie play, what would you say is sort of the signature play for you of the Miami era that represents the swashbuckling, you know, bleep you, swaggering, taunting, all that stuff?
Oh, it was when he ran into the tunnel.
Okay, so he, in Texas, here they are, two football fields worth of penalty yardage. He catches a touchdown pass. He's the fastest guy on the field by a lot. And he runs 100 yards past the end zone, through a tunnel, up a tunnel. A camera catches him looking back, you know, 100 yards removed from everything and everyone. And all he's doing is shooting in the dark, you know, gunslinging,
right.
finger guns. And his quote that, you know, "Hey, look. Blame the defensive back for not being able to cover me, and blame the architect of that building for putting a tunnel there."
I love that. Randall Thrill Hill. Who drafted him? Or Arizona?
The Dolphins traded for him. No, I think you're right. I think Arizona drafted him originally, and then the Dolphins traded for him. Or maybe it was the reverse. I think maybe the Dolphins drafted him and then traded him later to Arizona.
Well, we have another documentary that Ice Cube is doing about hip-hop and his music and the Raiders and Los Angeles and all that stuff is going to be hopefully really good. We haven't gotten a rough cut of that yet. Luther Campbell was in this. Like, you know, we really could have conceivably done a documentary about hip hop and college sports and the different impacts. Is that, can I say plural? Can I go plural on impacts there?
Yep.
Different impacts that it had with behavior and swagger and eventually dress with the Fab Five and all kinds of stuff. I don't know how that would be done. I guess you'd have to do it like Black Magic style, but I think that could be done. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think
some sort of merger there with the behavior of the athletes coinciding with the behavior of the lifestyle that the rappers had, and all of a sudden it was like in your face, look at me, I'm doing this, and that kind of started with Luther Campbell, and then obviously really opened up in the early 90s. But
yeah, the time period was Run DMC breaking through the Aerosmith video with, you know, not bad meaning, I mean, you know, with their music, which was not bad meaning bad, but bad meaning good, you know, and the Walk This Way, and like that's the time period when all of this started shifting in a way that made people uncomfortable. I mean, it is kind of the fact that I left out about that Luther Campbell and the Team Priest and the Bounties. This is a rapper whose lyrics were getting people arrested in Miami for buying them at the time, and it's a case that eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court. And you could write an entire column that would be uproarious of the Supreme Court justices sort of looking over now, explain to me the freedom of speech impact here of me so horny and pop that.
Right. It's amazing. Luther Campbell, like, for free speech, did about as much as anybody the last 20 years. Like, had as much of a pop culture impact as any human being.
I love that he was portrayed. He's never been portrayed the way he is in this film. He has had to climb through two decades of sewage to finally get... Like, how did you think he was portrayed in the film? Because I mean, he was so happy last night.
I loved it. I mean, for me, he finally passed Flavor Flav and reclaimed his status as the goofiest, you know, that one of those goofy figures from a different era that is somehow managing to live on. Because I thought he stole some of the scenes he was in the film.
He's the godfather of hip hop. He is the godfather of hip hop for South Florida.
And the godfather of explicit hip hop in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, I mean, it went to the Supreme Court, Bill. Like, it went. Think about that for a second. That they had a rapper on the sidelines whose lyrics were getting people arrested for buying them in South Florida.
It's nuts. You know, I had forgotten about that Sports Illustrated cover, which was one of the more unfair covers they've done. You know, urging the university to drop football. You were there when that happened. Walk me through everything.
Well, it was fairly mortifying to me because so much of what they were using to write that essay was stuff that I had written in the Miami Herald about Luther Campbell and these players, stuff that those guys thought was great, stuff that I thought was great, but I wasn't a columnist back then. I was a reporter. So I'm writing about all this stuff that I think is interesting and flamboyant and certainly newsworthy, but I don't believe it to be any kind of real wrong. I just believe it to be funny and weird and interesting and an interesting talking point that can get people started on, hey, should athletes be paid, and just open up a larger debate, which is all of this stuff that came out was framed within, hey, athletes should be paid. It was a whole series about that college athletes, that the Miami was making a lot of money off of these players and that these players were still dead ass broke. And so that's where it started, and Miami never ended up getting in any kind of real trouble for Luther Campbell paying players, because he wasn't a booster. He was just a guy on the streets. Like, he wasn't affiliated with the program in any real way.
He didn't do anything different than Sam Gilbert did for the John Wooden dynasty or about a million other people.
Right. But he was doing it for black kids.
Yeah.
And
well, didn't this come down to the administration, though? I mean, the administration wanted this to be this happy school in Florida that anybody would apply to, and not a school that was associated with all this stuff. That was the problem in a nutshell.
Yeah, it was a public relations thing. They wanted to be known for... Well, the problem in a nutshell is the tension that you find throughout college athletics, which is they wanted the street near the library to make money. They wanted to take money from the street, but when the street got a little too close to the library, oh, wait a minute. Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, what about academia? What about higher learning? What's this doing over here? But, you know, you can see the hypocrisy in that.
So you're saying it's almost like if a corporation hired somebody to push the envelope and then couldn't handle the consequences when that happened?
Are you speaking?
Well, I'm just, it seems to be the analogy you're making.
But you're not speaking of anything specifically there?
I don't know. Nothing.
You're not
in
mentioning,
general.
Like,
hey, listen, you push the envelope, you gotta stand by the fire.
Right.
Tell me about Miami as a sports town right now.
Most
popular team.
Well, the most popular team is always the Dolphins. Like, that's the team that the generations grew up with here.
I mean, second.
Second, if they're winning, the Hurricanes. If the Hurricane football team is winning, winning big, then they would be second.
Bandwagon.
Oh my God, it's the biggest. Yeah, it's the biggest bandwagon town in America. We will absolutely fill your baseball stadium for Game 7 of the World Series if you give it to us. But first round and the second round of the playoffs, not so much. We'll start paying attention about third inning of Game 4 of the World Series if you're up 2-1.
Miami Heat?
I mean,
one of the best five players in the league, and the entire lower bowl is empty except for like 20 people.
Yeah, I mean, they're all struggling down here. All the teams are struggling down here. And I do wonder... You know, whether they're going to make a big, big push at LeBron James. They're going to try and get him here with Dwayne. Do you think...
0% chance.
Okay, but as a man of substantive ego, could you work with somebody who was your peer if I told you... I mean, because it's supposed to be winning time, right? That's what it's... the illusion of sports is that everyone's supposed to care about winning above all else, not about any of the other things. That's the idea anyways.
Yeah.
If I told you you're going to have someone who is your equal, and you're going to hog championships with that person, what's the parallel in our business? Like, what, you and he can start a website and it will be the biggest website in sports journalism.
Now, that's you can't compare it to writing or anything else. Say, basketball, I think, is very specific. Somebody always has to be the alpha dog. And I don't see how they sort that out. And you know what? I also don't think if LeBron's going to leave Cleveland, he's going to leave Cleveland for his own thing. You know, I've thought about this a lot, you know, because there was this whole rumor in Los Angeles about the Lakers are going to try to make a run at LeBron and he wants to play with Kobe. He'd be in L.A. I don't think that helps LeBron to have somebody else help him win the title. I do think he wants to get the credit. I think he's like anybody else. He wants to be the guy who, oh, thank you, LeBron. Thank you for bringing us a title. I don't think he wants to come to Miami and be like, oh, yeah, thanks for winning us our second title in 5 years and winning it only because you decided to play Dwayne Wade.
It's such a dumb thing, though, Bill. Like, do you want to win or do you not want to win? Like, I understand that a lot of...
It's not about the winning. Totally. He's about, you know, positioning himself as a major, major, major superstar in a big market and...
But what if
accomplishing things outside of basketball?
But what if you were boys with the guy? Like, it's not just a guy. You're not just joining Kobe. You're joining. I mean, when Dwayne Wade goes to Cleveland, he stays at LeBron's house. When LeBron is here, they spend a lot of time together. Like, there. I wasn't saying just two guys, two big egos. I'm talking about two friends with big egos. And not.
Well, that's the thing is that, you know, there is a school of thought, and I've heard this, and it's a rumor, and it's, you know, not substantiated, obviously, but people do seem to feel like. It is conceivable that in some hotel room in Beijing at like 3 a.m. after some poker game, these guys were all sitting around and said, screw it, let's all play together. All right, you do this. So Bosch and I'll go to Miami or we'll go to New York or whoever has the cap space. We'll go there summer 2010. And then Chris Paul's like, yeah, and I'll be there 2012. And they all shook hands. It's a conspiracy theory, but it is floating around.
They're legit friends is what it is. They are. They're not guys who just see each other and give each other pounds. I mean, if someone stays at your home the way Dwayne does when he's with LeBron in Cleveland, stays at your home, that's I'm asking you that question. I'm asking you the question. Make it one of your boys, like one of your guys. Don't make it some fictional creature, because you were mentioning alpha dog, and I think you're right, because I love that quote from Kobe the other day for cutthroat efficiency when they asked him about about Andrew Bynum and sharing shots, and he just said, everyone knows I eat first.
Yeah. I went to the game last night. He doesn't shoot for the first quarter. He lets Bynum get a shot, and then when time comes to take over, he takes over.
But what about in the Magic Kareem dynamic? Who was the alpha dog?
Well, that was the thing. I wrote about this in my book. You know, Kareem was the alpha dog all the way through the 85 finals. In 86, he didn't have it anymore, but Magic was afraid to take the reins. And that's why they lost to the Rockets, because they had this whole, well, he's not the alpha dog, but I don't want to step on his toes. And so then in 87, that was the year Magic took over. He won the MVP. He bumped up his scoring. He became their crunch time guy, and they beat the Celtics in the finals. Mm-hmm. But it was uneasy. And I think you saw it in the 2008 in the gold medal game. You know, tie game against Spain, 10 minutes left. Somebody had to take over. They all looked to Kobe. He took over. At some point, somebody has to take over. That's how you win in basketball. So with the LeBron Wade thing, I don't know. It certainly has never happened before.
I know it hasn't happened before, and just because something hasn't happened before, I think we make this mistake in sports all the time. It's almost literally a childish way to view sports. Like, you know, when a kid hides, he doesn't think his parents can see him, even though he can, you know, if he can't be seen, he doesn't think his parents can see him. And we do this in sports all the time. Just because we haven't seen something doesn't mean it can't happen.
You're saying just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it can't happen.
Well, Peyton Manning couldn't win the big one. Roy Williams, everybody else. I mean, how many times have you heard that? Bill Cowher. Everybody's gotten hit with that.
Well, put it this way. The only time it has happened, and, you know, this is a little different because they were two, a center and a guard, was Shaq and Kobe, and that fell apart.
Yeah, and I guess it could fall apart, but you're telling me, think about what you're saying, because you're saying this is what it's going to fall apart over. You're telling me the possibility is there for these guys to hog the championships for the next 5 or 6 years and be Michael Jordan-ish. And you're telling me that the only thing standing in the way from that, of that really, because it's not money, it's not, I mean, they can make
well, there's two, hold on, there's three things standing in the way. One is the Alpha Dog thing. One is the fact that in Miami, it's a terrible atmosphere for a basketball game. And I do think LeBron feeds off that. Like, he gets a complete rush.
If he were here, it would no longer be a terrible.
Well, you guys were in the 2006 finals and could barely sell out.
No, when Shaq and Dwayne were here, it became an event. It became a sceney thing. No, if he were here.
And then the next year, it wasn't. You were defending champs and you couldn't even sell out.
If he were here, it would be that kind of scene all the time. But essentially,
I'm just telling you how he feels. I think he goes to the one or two times he plays at MSG every year. I think mm-hmm. he gets a rush from the crowd and the electricity and the history. Mm-hmm. And basketball is just different there, and you can feel it. And it's, you know, in my opinion, it's the best setting for a game, and it's got people that have been going to the games for 40 years, kind of like what you have with the Dolphins.
But
it's passed down through generations, and you have people who have been going to the game since they were 20 and are now 67, bringing their grandkids. And I think he gets a rush out of all that stuff, to be honest.
Oh, but ultimately, you're saying, I mean, whether a rush or not, and look, where he goes, fame follows and applause follows. But ultimately, what you're saying is the biggest deal breaker between it actually happening, even though there are other variables, is the idea that he would have to live with whatever stigma comes with, hey, Dwayne could win one by himself. You needed Dwayne to win one.
And I think that's part of it. I think the fact that Miami doesn't have that kind of energy that New York or even L.A. would have, I think, is part of it.
But
and
Cleveland,
I also think
Cleveland didn't have that energy until he got there. I mean, it's not like Cleveland had that energy. He brings that energy where he goes, doesn't he?
There's a feeling, though, that I think if he leaves Cleveland, which would be a huge deal, and he totally understands the ramifications of that, you know, that basically murders basketball in Cleveland and turns them into Milwaukee, Memphis, Charlotte, and all the other franchises that are barely making it and don't matter. So if he does that, I think he goes to New York or LA. I think that's the only way it's acceptable to people in Cleveland. I think that's the only way he can sell it, because he can talk about how he wants to do this, 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 and this outside of basketball. You go to Miami, you're basically saying, yeah, good luck, everybody. I went for the good weather to play with my buddy and to, you know, tax-free. Those are my three reasons. Thanks, though.
And to win,
He's going to win wherever he goes.
Well, no,
see, the guy wins 60 games by himself.
No, but
team on Cleveland is awful this year, and they're going to win 60 games.
But win big. Win championship big. Like, if I give you those things, don't make it sports, Bill. If I say to you, hey, tax-free, great weather, fun city, get to play with your boy, one of your best friends, and you're in all likelihood you're going to do a lot of winning. Those don't sound like bad reasons.
Are you making the case for me to move to Miami and do your radio show with you, or for LeBron James?
I think we should start up a whole new BSPN, Bill Simmons with BSPN.
Let's Eric Rideon Productions. Yeah, I don't know why I don't live in Florida, to be honest, because I could live anywhere, and the taxes here are just, they've gone to degrees that I didn't know they were capable of going, and I can't believe that I don't live in Florida. I guess the downer is the whole, you know, natural disaster part, which you have to be thinking about constantly.
Well, but you can have those there too, right? The earthquakes are sort of the same thing, aren't they?
These hurricanes come like once a year now.
We haven't had anything in a while, but yes, that's the thing that people,
You haven't had anything, but that coast, it seems to hit different parts once a year now.
Yeah. You get used to it, though. I imagine just like you get used to your house trembling, I get used to putting up
My house trembling. Do not get used to it. So wait a second. So Miami, they're going to have a ton of cap space next year. Do people think Wade comes back, or does it just depend on who comes there for him to stay?
I think everyone's expecting him to come back. He said everything that makes it indicates that he's going to come back. One of the things that I find interesting about how he's playing this year, and it's imperceptible, it's almost imperceptible because he's averaging 27, 6, and 5. His shooting percentage is way down. He's shooting 43%. And,
yep.
And this happens all the time. It happened to Kobe. It happened to Tracy McGrady. It happens to Vince Carter. They can get their shot whenever they want, so why not take their shot from outside where they don't have to get hit and fall on the floor near the rim? But to me, it brings up a more interesting discussion of, I mean, he's going into a free agent year. It's almost imperceptible, the difference in his game. He's just taking a lot more jumpers. He's going, by the end of this conversation, he's going to have taken more threes than he took in any of his first five or six seasons.
And he's a bad three-point shooter.
And he's bad, yeah. He's bad at that.
I noticed that. I've watched him three, four times this year, and I noticed that he shoots jumpers for the first three quarters, and then the fourth quarter, he starts going to the basket.
But wouldn't you do it that way? I guess.
Yes,
my question.
I would. I absolutely would.
But fans feel a right to feel bad about that because the team's not going anywhere this year. Everybody knows that. So, but I can understand why he would feel that way, and I can also understand on the other end why fans would be like, "What are you talking about? I pay for season tickets. How about you give me maximum? Why don't you give me maximum effort, even if it means going neck first to the rim?"
Because you're only talking about 11 fans who paid for season tickets. He could fit them all in a room and apologize to them one by one.
Right, 11 fans and three of them paid with suitcases of cocaine.
I thought I actually was very impressed by them against the Lakers, and I do think they're going to be a little bit sneaky in the playoffs this year because they finally at least have five guys that you can go to war with at crunch time. And yes, I'm including Quentin Richardson. And yes, I'm including Jermaine O'Neal's corpse. But Jermaine O'Neal is at least like showing signs of life. I don't know if the formaldehyde finally started to work wonders for
contract
him or what's going
year.
On.
Contract
but
year.
In that Lakers game, I saw five guys who knew how to play basketball and were professionals. And easily could have beaten the Lakers, a team that, by the way, is about to win like 25 straight games.
Yeah, but you
no
just
small
saw,
feat.
You saw their best game of the season. They all
I didn't, though. Dwayne Wade wasn't good in that game. He was like 5 for 19 at one point. I mean, they stayed in that game just by being smart and having five smart guys who know how to play and a good coach.
They also lost, or they also beat the Nets at home on a buzzer three from Dwayne falling out of bounds.
I know.
Like we're really talking about Heat basketball on the Bill Simmons podcast.
The Dwayne Wade thing is interesting to me because, Chicago is sitting there. Chicago is sitting there for him.
A national audience. You just told them that you want to go to war with Quentin Richardson. You just said that.
No. I didn't say I wanted to go to war. I said they at least have five guys now who are professionals, who have played in big games, who are not going to wilt, who would, not these guys that like Chris Quinn, who are like, who is this guy? This guy's in a playoff game right now. But I just think it's going to be interesting because Chicago is sitting there. He went to Marquette. He knows the Midwest well. He likes it. I could totally see he's from, isn't he from Chicago?
Yes.
The Bulls are sitting there. He could be the alpha dog. Derrick Rose isn't built to be an alpha dog. He's a second banana guy. He doesn't have that type of personality. That's immediately the best backcourt in the league. They have cap space. I don't know. I think to me it's more likely that he leaves and Miami is screwed, basically.
Doesn't it frustrate you about your sport? Because it frustrates me about basketball. We were having a conversation on the radio with Jeff Van Gundy about the fact that my co-host said there are six teams this year, Jeff, that can win the championship. There are only six in your sport that have a legitimate shot at the championship. And Jeff goes, who's your sixth?
Yeah, I would say there's four.
And my co-host said Denver. And Jeff is like, just no chance.
Yeah,
no,
it's four.
No chance.
And actually, it's one because I'm not reverse jinxing this. If there's no Laker injury, they're going to win the title game.
They're great,
they're really good.
I love, and you know how much I enjoy reading you, but sometimes your fan stuff to me gets in the way of clinical analysis.
Yeah, it's not going to do that. I am now being clinical. I think because I turned 40.
But you didn't want to run our test, and I'm like, what is he talking about?
No, I still the Ariza is still the move there. That was a mistake.
They're better this year.
Doesn't matter. They could win the title with you as the small forward. Ridiculous.
I love that this team, though, that a champion team took that kind of quote-unquote risk. And by the way, speaking of Ron Artest, is he going to pull this off? Is he going to be the only guy in the history of sports or not sports, in the history of mankind, to have a riot on his resume and be lovable?
And have a ring? Riot and a ring?
Because he's lovable, correct?
He went to practice apparently within the last 5 weeks in an Indy race car. He drove an Indy race car to practice. He's a lunatic.
Were you?
I still don't think it's worth the risk. In my opinion, if you are almost guaranteed to win the title with what you have, or at least make the finals, you don't risk that by switching somebody who was such a key glue guy for you for Ron Artest, who might single-handedly sink your team.
Glue guy drives me crazy. I mean,
Ariza's been good for Houston this year. He's been their best player.
Okay, and what are they going to do?
I'm just saying, I think he's better than Ron Artest. I think he can, you know, you saw, did you watch the Miami Laker game, or were you out like at some Cuban cigar place, some wine bar or something?
I was out with Luther Campbell mojitos. Booty dancing, actually. I had my hands on my knees and I was booty dancing.
Well, did you notice how they had to have Kobe guarding Dwayne Wade in the fourth quarter because nobody else in the team could guard him? That's a problem. Last year, Trevor Ariza is guarding him, and Kobe's saving his legs for offense. That is the issue with this team this year.
There's no issue with this team.
Well, that is an issue.
Did you break the story? Were you the one who broke the story? And I would say it's the best sports story of the last year. And
if the underwear,
the underwear, Ron Artest riding on the bus in his.
Yes. I would say that was more of a. I broke the anecdote. I hate to call that a story. A story is like breaking that Howard Schnellenberger is coming back to the University of Miami.
How about Jeff Van Gundy's response when I asked him what happens if Kobe Bryant? I mean, I love Jeff Van Gundy. I don't know how you feel about his analysis, but I think,
put it this way: I mailed him an autograph book, and I haven't mailed you one yet. How about that?
Oh, there you go. I love him, and we asked him, "Hey Jeff, if Kobe showed up for the last game, Game 7, he shows up on the bus in his underwear, and he gets off the bus. The punishment is," and he says, "That's the team uniform for the night."
It's true. Kobe is. I was lucky enough, thanks to the good people at ESPN Radio, because we have a deal with the Lakers. I actually sat courtside behind the Jazz basket last night. And Kobe's hold on the rest of his teammates is pretty dramatic when you're that close to it. The facial expressions and just the general. It goes beyond Alpha Dog. It's almost like watching a big brother with 11 little brothers. And I don't know if there's anyone else in the league like that right now.
Well, give me a better quote. I mean, you love the language and you love the way that athletes talk. Give me a quote that's more efficient than the one to explain sort of cutthroat. This is how it is efficiency than the one that he said when asked about sharing shots with.
I get to eat first. Yeah,
I eat first.
I eat first. It's true. Bird would have said the same thing. All those guys. I admired him last week for admitting that he didn't mean to bank the three-pointer in to win the game. Because I think 5 years ago he lies and claims, I just wanted to get some air under it and try to hit the square. And now he's like, yeah, I was lucky. I threw it up and it went in. I mean, the incredible thing about the shot was just that he got it off. And I think, you know, he's like, yeah, I threw it up there and it went in.
Have you in your career ever made this kind of 180 on somebody?
It's not a 180. I think his record from 2001 to 2007 stands for itself. I do think that he has evolved, and it does seem like his teammates like him. And I mean, Jesus, you got to admire how hard this guy works. I was watching him last night. He's doing McHale post-up moves on who was it? Ronnie Brewer. He's got drop steps now, and it's insane. I don't think anybody works harder on their game.
I think a mistake that we make all the time in sports. I remember, you know, Allen Iverson, when he got to the finals, he became, you know, more mature and changed.
And, he didn't change.
And reinvented. No, he was. Yeah. But we never like to admit that we're wrong. So now you've. I don't know whether he's liked by his teammates or not. The times that I've talked to Lamar Odom about it, I get the distinct impression that there's an uneasy tension. But now that he's won without Shaq, I wonder how much reinventing we're doing of him and how he is, because it becomes hard worker and, you know, teammates, maybe his teammates like him now. Maybe he's changed. I just find that most formed adults, most men, once they reach 30, don't do a hell of a lot of evolving. And then when I put it in sports and make the athlete, you know, the athlete's always been the pretty girl. The pretty girl never has to evolve because unless she's self-interested in evolving, because everyone tells her she's fine the way that she is. Like the idea that if I had to bet, do you think Kobe has really changed or he hasn't changed? Gun to your head, which one would you choose there?
I like how you are now controlling the podcast. I think he has changed. I don't think it's a change like somebody, you know, changing their opinion on Roe versus Wade, like that kind of a change. I think it's a lot of subtle things. I think he put a lot of thought after, you know, the Gasol trade and after the 2008 finals into, all right, how can I win a title? What are the things I have to do? I don't think a lot of those choices were willing. And I still think he likes to be the guy that gets the attention and all the acclaim and all that stuff. And we saw that happen in the finals last year. He wanted to win, but he also wanted to win on his terms. And he took a lot of shots and he tried to be the hero. But at the same time, I do think he's gotten a lot better at interacting with his teammates, not selling him out. Because he was doing a lot of stuff on the court that he doesn't do anymore. You know, eye rolls, how could he not catch that pass, screaming at guys, MFing his coach. And he doesn't do it anymore, apparently. I think he's realized that a lot of the extraneous stuff was hurting, you know, the goal. And I also think you got to admire anybody, and only a few athletes have been able to do this in the NBA, somebody who has tinkered and changed with their game as the years went along and conceded the effects of time. You know, like this guy is like, all right, in the 2008 finals, the Celtics beat him up. He couldn't get to the rim on him. He was a jump shooter, and they really, you know, he had a bad series because of how the Celtics played him, and he really put thought into it. It was like, all right, what do I have to do to make that not happen again? And he changed his game. Like, you admire that, right?
I absolutely.
How many athletes would say, all right, what do I have to do? How can I get better? And I think there's only a few guys who think that way and actually execute it.
I find him to be one of the more fascinating creatures in our sports lifetime.
Best of the decade. Well, actually now you're going to, I guess Tiger has surpassed him because Tiger's like, you know, Don Draper. but yeah.
What do you do with this story? I was doing a magazine piece about Shaquille O'Neal when he was with the Lakers for ESPN's magazine, and I couldn't get any access to him while I was in Los Angeles whatsoever. And we did it anyways. We put it on the cover. But
you
I
should have pretended you were somebody else's fiance who played in the league.
I'm looking for him and I'm trying to get him. I never get him anyway. So I get very little help from the Lakers. And then a few years later, I'm in Miami. I'm not doing very much nationally. I get a call from the Lakers. Hey, Kobe would like to have lunch with you.
What year was this?
This would have been 3 years ago.
Yeah, that was the image rehabilitation season.
But how about that, though? Like,
that's
I don't have any link to him whatsoever. This was just them calling a random Miami columnist asking, hey, would you like to have lunch with Kobe Bryant? I thought my friends were pranking me because I couldn't get any access to these people when I was there going to put them on the cover of a magazine. Now, here he was calling. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much he's changed, but I know that he's certainly trying, based on that information, I can make the extrapolation that he's certainly trying to change the way that you view him.
Yeah, he's been trying to do that for 4 years. I think now he's reached a point where he feels like he changed that perception, and now he just worries about kicking ass with the Lakers. At least that's my perception of it. I mean, you know, armchair analysis as always, but... Tiger or Kobe for most fascinating guy of the decade?
Oh, my God. Can I go Ricky Williams there?
No, Ricky Williams is just a...
I think you're going to find that 30 for 30. Have you seen any of that yet? Have you seen any of the cuts on that?
They just mailed it to me today.
Look at that, and let's rehab this conversation.
We're going to be talking about Kobe 200 years from now. We neither of us will be alive, but somewhere we'll be talking about him. I think that's how... polarizing he was this decade. He's at least the most polarizing athlete we've had this decade.
How do you feel about what's happened with Tiger? Have you written anything about this?
I have a big two-part column going up tomorrow. I have a lot of different opinions.
Because I think sports coverage has changed forever. Who's going to sleep at night now? Who's the guy in sports going to sleep at night most scared? Because this has never happened before in sports where we climb into your bedroom this way. And allow TMZ and the National Enquirer to lead us by the nose.
See, I disagree. I don't buy that argument.
It's happened before?
I just think the way it's happened has changed, but I still think, you know, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, so people always did this.
No, but when have we ever done this with athletes, with mistresses and texts? And when have we ever done any of this with an athlete where his shame, his private life, not illegalities, not rapes and assaults, immoralities. When have we covered them this way with a 24-hour news cycle? Give me an example of I've never seen this before.
It's the first time it's happened with an athlete, but, you know, why wouldn't it happen
with
an athlete?
Oh, it's happened with politicians and celebrities.
Yeah, celebrities.
Sure.
This goes, you know, people forget, like, Donna Rice and Gary Hart, all that stuff.
Oh, sure.
The same thing.
Yes.
For some reason, it's always been hands-off in sports. And, you know, I think there's one person from the last 20 years, who we won't name, who is very relieved that that was the case. Somebody who peaked in the late 80s and early 90s, I think, could not be more relieved that he was doing his career right now.
He was walking around South Beach the other day in dad jeans and with a hoop, a pirate hoop earring.
Oh, my God.
He can wear whatever he wants and always be cool, right?
Pretty much. I think he can.
The pirate hoop earring?
Well, I do think, and I wrote about this in the column, like, I do think a big part of this Tiger thing plays around the fact that we knew nothing about him and he was a blank slate, and that is a bigger part of this than we realize. Like, if this was, I don't know, Dwayne Wade, or if this was, even better, LeBron James. Let's say this is LeBron James and all this stuff happens. I just don't think people would care as much. I think the difference is that Tiger's been in our life for 13 years and we knew nothing about him.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, wow. You know, it's like this curtain's been lifted. Oh my
what do you
God.
Think? How do you think he's experiencing this? Do you think, given his image stuff, given his privacy, I imagine him curled up in the fetal position on his living room.
I bet he's mad. I do think that he's going to take it out on the PGA Tour.
But don't you wish he would come out? I mean, in our lifetime, tell me if you've seen any more of these, because I know Iverson did it and Barry Bonds did it. But I would love to see him come out and say, look, I'm profound. He can't do it and he won't do it. But I would love to see him come out and say, look, I am profoundly sorry for the mistakes I've made for my family. I
should have done that a week and a half ago.
No. But kiss my like, you guys don't belong in my life this way. Like, when do we see that press conference? Like, you guys do not belong. Look, these are my mistakes. I am really sorry to the people that I have harmed. Those people are not you. Those people live in my home.
You really believe that, though?
I would like to see the only
but do,
two.
Do you believe that's true? That this isn't salient information?
Salient for whom? Like, because we want it? Because we crave it? Because we like it? We're entitled to it?
I don't know. If you're going to make nine figures from sponsors and position yourself a certain way, and it turns out that maybe you aren't that way.
Well,
I feel like that's a story.
Well, but position yourself. I mean, he wasn't selling us family values. He was selling us razors. I mean, he wasn't running on a platform of morality. I mean, he was, you know.
I'm not saying it was a platform of morality. I'm saying it was the good guy platform.
But didn't we make that for him? Like, didn't we? He kept saying, I want to be on my boat named Privacy.
This is a guy who greenlighted a commercial of little kids saying, I am Tiger Woods. I mean, okay. How can you say that, you know, at that point you're opening the door a little, I think.
I guess.
You're saying that you are this exalted figure that everybody should aspire to be and buy my product because I am Tiger Woods. Buy Nike shoes. I am Tiger Woods. I don't know. It's you're opening the door for that to backfire if you so
sure.
choose to act like an ass.
They're commercials, though. I mean, if you're buying commercials as who someone is, he's not lying to you. You're lying to you. I mean, if you're commercials. If you what can I say about the commercials that you have on ESPN? What sort of if you have some sort
I don't
of,
have any. Okay, I wish I ones, had one.
Don't you've never had like you've never been mentioned or anything?
I was in some sort of website commercial. I don't know.
I wouldn't
consider myself a role model.
I think that we just want this information on him. We delight in it. I get it. I understand it. Every morsel is consumable and delicious, even though it's cotton candy and it's poisonous. But you know, I think that we will rationalize all of our behavior because we simply want this information, and I don't think it's.
I kind of wrote about that. It's embarrassing. I think we're all embarrassed as we digest the story. And put it this way. Let's say I send you an email right now and it says crazy Tiger Woods picture, do you say, I don't want to look at that. I want to respect that guy's privacy. No, you click on it and you open it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the issue, is that that's just the way society works now. We don't care if stuff's true or half true or one third true, but it's more the actual event itself.
That should bother you a little bit, though, right? That would bother you. It would certainly bother you.
Well, I know society sucks. This was a newsflash? Watch The Bachelor. Watch VH1.
It's easy to shrug your shoulders about it, and I'm always tilting at these windmills, you know, with my giant stick of compassion that everyone laughs at. But it's easy to shrug your shoulders and say it's just so when it's not you. You wouldn't like it so much. I know you may can be thin-skinned.
I know I wouldn't like it. Well, I'm not saying that I would like it or I wouldn't, but this is a guy who was the biggest athlete of the past since Jordan.
Yeah, but a third of the stuff may be true like that, and that's what's spreading.
Well, my two issues is that people can no longer delineate between what is a reputable news source and what's not. And if something's on TMZ, that means it's true. If something's on Radar Online, then it has to be true. If a porn actress, any porn actress can basically come out and say, oh yeah, I slept with Tiger Woods, and she gets thrown into the growing list of people who've slept with him, it's a porn actress. It's somebody who has sex for money. I mean, I'm pretty sure that a couple of them are going to bend the truth to get their name in the story. So I think that's where I have a problem. And then the other problem I have is, you know, and Whitlock is a passion of his, but these people going on with giving advice to Tiger on how he should handle it and putting on the Dr. Phil mustache. I mean, come on.
That's so great.
Do I need to see that on my TV program or in my column?
Absolutely. To laugh, to demand answers about where Tiger Woods was going.
Hey, the one part I don't get, and I just wonder if he's a smart guy. He might just be good at golf and not be that smart of a guy, because to leave the voicemail and put your name on it is not the move of a smart celebrity who is in control of his actions at all.
Well, how about this one, though? How about this one? It's one thing to leave your name, but how unfortunate is his name for this particular circumstance? Because
right. You couldn't say John.
There are. But not only that, it's the weird thing of he said Tiger. There aren't a lot more of those. And then if his second choice was Eldrick, so that wasn't going to help him either.
Well, you know what you go with there? You say, hey, it's me.
Yeah.
Me is going to do fine. I think she's going to recognize your voice, Tiger.
I'm sure, Bill, that he could have avoided all of this if he had just changed a couple of syllables. If he had just said, hey, it's me. This all plays out differently.
But this is why this is such a big story, because there's so many different dumb elements to it that are just fun to talk about. And I hate to use the word fun, but you know, I've talked about that Tiger voicemail with 20 people, and we're all like, what is he thinking? This is a terrible idea. Like, and there's just all these different wrinkles to it. And this is the thing that, like, for instance, the Michael Vick story didn't have, or, you know, even the Clemens story and the Artest Melee. The only really kind of funny thing about the Artest Melee was Steven Jackson taking his shirt off at the end. Just how mad, you know, he really looked like he was ready to fight the entire arena.
No, and you're forgetting Jamal Tinsley running around in the bowels of the stadium and emerging with a dustpan on a stick.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I also forgot about Jermaine O'Neal punching Turtle from Entourage. So, yeah, I guess there were a couple funny things, but ultimately not a great story for humor. And this one just, you know, now we have porn stars. You know, this is being covered like a real, 6 months ago, this porn star mentioned she had sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, then that must be true.
That must be true.
I mean, it's like there's so many dumb elements to this. Anyway, all right. You have to do a radio show.
Buddy, good talking to you. Good catching up with you.
Thank you for being on the 30 for 30 series, The U, premiering Saturday night right after the Heisman special.
Quentin Richardson is the next one.
Quentin Richardson.
And the next 30 for 30, going to war with Quentin Richardson.
You know what? That could have been a good 30 for 30 is Q and D Miles. the lost Warriors, Q and D Miles. Or what do they call that thing? The antennas? The antenna era.
the pounding on the forehead with the fists?
Yep.
Could have done it. That's what it's called.
All right, Dan Le Batard, good talking to you. Oh, wait, plug your Twitter quickly.
Oh, the Twitter. Are you going to give us some Twitter love? I got a couple of things to plug here. We got, our hockey announcer does goal calls for us that are random pop culture references. So that's on YouTube, Randy Moeller goal calls. It's funny. You'd like that if you saw some of those. And then, it's Twitter at Lebatard Show. Man, you got an enviable following, my man. That's a pretty cool thing that you got going.
It's like 90% porn bots. You also be appearing at the Comedy Store on December 27th and the Laugh Factory on December 28th.
I'm going to be performing with Dan Dickow.
Okay, good. All right. Dan Levitard, thank you very much.
See you, buddy.
What if I told you that for three glorious years, football season never ended? That a marching band played a 12-year halftime show? What if I told you that a rugby scrum could help heal a nation? Or that the guy sitting in aisle 4, row 8, seat 113 was going to be more famous than anyone on the field? What if I told you that a movie could change the way you look at sports? From ESPN Films, 30 stories, 30 filmmakers, 30 years. ESPN 30 for 30, presented by Levi's.